Thank you everyone for coming. I'd like to welcome you to OpenTech. If you want to tweet about it, please use the hashtag OpenTech. And we'll thank ODI for the generous sponsorship which has allowed the event to happen, and for UKUG to work for the organisational help with it. But I'd like to start off with Lisa Mark, who is talking on pharmacification.
Hi everyone. Are you hearing me from this or? Hi everyone. Thank you so much for waking up early Saturday morning to listen to a girl talk about joysticks. I'll leap straight into it. So basically, at the time when there were all these great research and expectation from our understanding from the gaming community, you know, we know everything now to do with health, social input, help with depression, how it creates societies, and how the health benefits, whatever, of gaming. But I thought, well, there isn't really much studies about the maker world, you know, what happens to these makers of these gaming industry. So I went to stay in a joystick factory in China, in Shenzhen. And because we tend to be conscious, right, of Chinese factory workers in terms of a working mass. For example, we often hear about this impressive scale rather than relate to these workers as people. I'm just going to stand up because there's quite a lot of people at the back. And in the media, when we discuss factory salaries, they're really talking about these people in terms of economic value. And for my work, I often work with fringe communities as a speculative designer researcher. I knew that focusing on really sensationalist extremes makes these people very difficult for us to relate to on a human scale. So I went and plunged myself straight into their mundane events, which is eating in their canteens and slept in their dormitories and watch soap opera with them. Please come in. So I'm going to go through some of the insights.
A typical joystick factory such as this one in the suburbs of Shenzhen produces them. There are a lot more stories hiding behind the walls of this factory than are Western stereotypes of unsafe conditions and financial exploitation. Considering that there are more than 230 million Chinese factory workers, which is about 3/4 of the entire US population, we really ought to know much more about them. To address this, in summer 2011, I came to the city of Shenzhen, the largest manufacturing base in China.
I'm living with them, making friends with the joystick factory workers. During the day, the workers would gather together their chopsticks to eat together in the factory canteen. And we had a Sichuan chef. I don't know if anyone knows their way around Chinese food. Do you know Sichuan food? It's like a super spicy food. So we had a Sichuan chef, and the female workers would often complain about its impact on their skin conditions. We're all covered with pizza face from the spices, and the girls would protest by picking out mountains of these chopped chilies from their dishes and piling it directly onto the tables. And in the evenings, the young workers, they'd come and gather out in these snack streets in the factory complexes. And that's really when these areas come to life at night. And each herbalist and you've got herbalists and noodle makers and hot pot sellers. And so each sort of small stall and convenience shop would bring out their own television sets from their own homes and pushing them into the streets, switching on a different channel. And that's the best advertisement ever, because you've got these different crowds of people gathering according to the preferences of the, you know, the TV channels. And every 12 minutes, everyone would sort of get back to their normal businesses, only to reunite again to continue with their favorite soaps. And at night, the workers would return to sleep within the unisex factory dorms, and in these sort of the only really invisible privacy of the mosquito nets. And as I was there, I realized that some of these spaces were actually decorated by spider plants grown, snuck in by some very nostalgic gardener, and they were growing it in plastic bottles. So in the next clip, we're going to talk about some of the issues that led to the idea of farmification.
A more pressing problem for this joystick factory community, however, is that people don't really buy joysticks anymore. The era of iPhones, iPads, and joystickless games like Kinect sees the end of the peripheral market. These factories are facing difficult decisions, and the workers, who'd invested time and energy building relationships, will lose their jobs, the roof over their heads, as well as their friends. I began to think about how these communities are created by our Western technological demands, and how design might be used to help these communities remain meaningful when our demands change. And the food question cropped back again. If there are 230 million migrant workers, this means that there are 200 million less farmers. Again, who's making all the food? Back in the joystick factory, I presented to the bosses the dangers in concentrating all the workforce only in manufacturing, and also the alienation of the workers from their countryside origins. I proposed to the bosses that workers be allowed to do part-time farming. The managers liked the idea of a financial buffer in times of difficulty using lands just down the road. Other factories also became interested and began asking questions. In fact, we even had offers to sell the produces of the part-time farm back to the eateries in the Sack Street. You could call it a kind of farmification of the manufacturing process. In my month's research year at the joystick factory in Shenzhen, I had the privilege of getting to know the workers and respect their codependence on the community. My observations have resulted in a part-time farming scheme that would allow the migrant workers to gain control over their future lives in relation to their past values. And I've also become aware of the threat to this community each time our eyes glint on the latest tech fad.
So farmification is really this real-life solution that explores the in-depth it's an in-depth research of the maker world. But as often is the case, you end up spending ages making a project, and then you spend even longer unpicking the project or undoing it. So often in design, what happens is that the next challenge would be to take it to a policy level. So for example, it could be something like a possible responsible life-work balance standard, similar to the free-from-animal-testing labels that we've become quite accustomed to as a consumer. But this is a really paternalistic relationship to the manufacturing world. So if you think about it, although in my practice I realized was about making functional solutions, but the goal of the research isn't, sort of dictating what a good practice should be. So next I'm going to explain how farmification can be applied to expanding and inviting more ideas. So, I'm going to do it using three animals because I heard this research that it increases people's concentration levels looking at cute animals. The first one, when I first proposed farmification in China, I was literally laughed out of China. I'm not kidding. But within half a year, some of the iron factories, iron factories that were producing iron for the property bubble, found that they were also in a loss of demand, right, when the bubble had burst. What were they going to do? They stopped their own farmification by growing pigs. And this is ironically seen with very mixed feelings from the Chinese media, from the public as well. So a lot of people still view agriculture with prejudice. And, you can still find this out now. And the first factory that did this really got slated. Now as more and more people are doing it. And now the government's sort of saying that if you're going to start doing this sort of way of farmification, you really should move out and move back out of the cities and leave the space for other manufacturers to use it. And on a personal level, I totally agree that telling people to go back to farming, reverting farming, is actually not empowering at all. So really the next steps is about how do you integrate this new kind of industrial lifestyle that the workers have gained with all the skills to maybe hack farming and decode these social connotations we have with both the cliches of traditional agriculture as well as the industrial factory farms. And at the moment, the only connection between these two is something that's really horrendous, battery farms. So how do we, you know, use this opportunity to find that new possibility? The next one is Miles. This is Gerbil, but it's Miles. So despite our efforts, you know, we get asked a lot about how this factory is doing now. And but this Miles empire, I mean, it's huge. Probably a third of all the mice we click on is from that. They've been encroaching into the facility. So our factory had to downsize a little bit as the mouse factory expanded. But really, the impact of how factory workers have been sort of pushed into the fringes of this innovation cycle is growing. I was told by an educator that a couple of years ago, if a teacher in the classroom was to tell a story of the little mouse, the kids would immediately think of the clicky computer mouse as opposed to, you know, the rodents with furry ears. And within just a couple of years, this new generation have started to, you know, think about the organic mouse again. And in fact, I've been hearing from these sort of now in education sectors, they're having massive debates about whether if it's even worth the effort in teaching these, you know, classic pointer devices. And really, it was actually a surprise to Douglas Engelbert that, you know, the inventor of the mouse, how long it actually lasted for. So really designing for those affected by the end of innovation demands is kind of a no-brainer. So could this mouse factory face the same sort of possible prospect of becoming obsolete? And this is some of the clippings. And really, if we look at it, this is something that could actually affect all manufacturers. So I don't know if any of you have heard this Chris Anderson's book, Makers, and it's telling us this story about, it's quite classic, about how skilled workers in large facilities are being outsourced in this age of DIY web makers. And we're told that the world of, you know, bits as in data must translate to a world of real as in things. And really, you know, let's push it one step further. The world of things relies on a world of people, and people need food. So this is looping back chicken. Right, so, you know, I'm this Chinese girl, and I go to a factory, I'm in Beijing, I see my friends, and you end up ordering something that's your, you know, nostalgic motherland cuisine. I order chicken feet. For me, it's something that's kind of, you know, I'll say it's centuries of tradition, lots of skilled labor, and it's seen as a, you know, local delicacy. But now in this new century of, you know, globalized middle class people, they're seeing that it's quite barbaric. You know, we get quite squirmish about this kind of food. So some of my friends tried to put me off, and they said, you know, raw chicken feet are being exported out of American battery farms straight into Chinese cuisines as waste. I'm like, wow, this is a really wonderful story. I mean, if you think about everything we're combating in biolabs, anything from, we've got carps, bullfrog, crayfish, rabbits, pigeon, jellyfish. I mean, why can't we just eat them? If you think about it from this level of saying, you know, why can't you mix farming with agriculture? I mean, mix farming with manufacturing. Well, why can't we do this? And before we were, you know, activists by refusing to eat certain types. But what if we were activists by performing to eat, to extinguish and control rather than quietly abstaining? So as societies and consumers, we should be demanding much more from the food systems. In the past few years, we've seen activism move from a very fringe sphere into this integral part of the digital world in Anonymous and media in WikiLeaks and architecture in Occupy. And we already express the way, you know, ourselves by the way we eat. And in regions when people don't really have the opportunity to express their political views in traditional ways, this could be a productive activism that could actually gain support with, you know, very tangible results. So this is an area where almost, you know, political foodism is where, you know, agriculture is the platform. And so before I leap into any further in my later project and you have a heart attack, well, I'll I'll conclude it. So I've really appreciated this opportunity to share some of my ideas. So we've looked at how farmification promotes a change in the expectations of food systems and manufacturing to join these two separate cycles. And what I'm hoping through these sort of curious proposals is to make us think a bit more critically and demand more from technology, design, food, and really to grasp this very fuzzy, aspirational, very grand and challenged thing that we call the future. Thank you.
A couple minutes for questions.
Hello.
I'm interested in the power relationships in the factory that you were talking about there. There's sort of marginalisation of the word workers, and I was wondering what the sort of, when you were staying with them, how many people were migrant workers who come directly from agriculture? How many were second generation? How many? When you talk about farmification as a sort of backup option, how many people get to go back into farming?
It's actually a very interesting question. So there are two questions. The first one was how many were second generation, and that's really been an issue lately because most second-generation people don't want to be factory workers. They you know, that this aspiration has changed. And as we're, you know, so I remember literally hacking into broadband and, you know, literally, you know, begging and bribing other workers to hook up. And we had people like Spider-Man crawling five floors across this factory dorm just to get us broadband and, you know, and then to set up VPN. And it was kind of an amazing experience to know that how easy actually is to get this knowledge across on the internet from, you know, from different people. So this aspiration is kind of really spreading out, and people have different ideas what they're going to do. So I'd say it's mostly a combination of first generation workers complaining about second generation workers and not, you know, setting their heart down on doing this, but it's a very wise idea about, you know, trying out other things and, you know, not putting eggs in one basket. That's my motto. Say that again about the.
Just how many people wanted to go back into farming if they come from a, you know, a farming background and the aspiration had been to get into.
Right. So this is the thing. When you explain about farming, they tell you about the harshness of the life they've had, the unpredictable, you know, nature, and how difficult it is to get income and education, and that's why they left. So farming for them is a very geographic situation rather than you know a skill, but. If you can mix both, and people were hanging out near these like strawberry fields in the area, because also industrial life is very alienating for someone that's lived all their life in agriculture.
We'll need to move on to the next one. Thanks very much.
Yes.
I don't actually know the next speaker, but I've not got the name. So
is it me, Francis?
This is on House on GitHub.
Yes, it's me. While I'm getting this working, can you think of things which you've done maybe 10, 20 years ago that at the time everyone thought you were a bit weird and nerdy, and now everyone does them? So just try and think of some of those things, and if you think of something, stick your hand up.
Portable two-way radio communication.
Anything else?
TiVo.
Yeah. Email.
Maintaining lists of friends.
Going and staying with random strangers and on the internet.
Okay, so this is really an excuse for me to talk about what markets are and what products are and what innovation is. This quote is from Chris Dixon's blog, who's got a blog post about the general idea of what geeks do now is in their spare time, is what everyone does in 10 years' time. An example where this happened to me, I think it was about 1997, I first put my CV online on my website, and everyone thought this was really weird and public. Like, your career history, so that anyone around the world wants to see that. And this guy, Reid Hoffman, came along and has managed to bully everyone into putting their CV on the internet. Like, literally everyone now. LinkedIn has reached the point where you cannot function in most, you know, in corporations without being on LinkedIn anymore. And they're using it as the internal direction. It's better than HR's own directory of people. And there's this well-known height cycle graph. It's so well-known, I've completely forgotten even the name of the guy who invented it in the 1960s. Does anyone know? Remember? Right, okay, we don't know. innovators, early adopters, early majority, late majority, laggards. Has everyone seen this before? I'm just going to see how dominant the idea it is. Yeah. So the innovators are me putting my CV on the internet. And then there's this. There's a famous Silicon Valley book, Crossing the Chasm, about jumping between these gaps. It's actually quite hard as they're making a product, whether it's a for-profit company or a non-profit or government, to get from innovators to early adopters or from early adopters to the majority. And he calls it the chasm. And the clever bit that Reid did was get all the people in Silicon Valley, the VCs, to start putting their CVs online, and that created social pressure for other people in a kind of primate hierarchy to do it. And he managed to sort of do a kind of market-side hack to get everyone to do what I realised it was useful for everyone to have their CVs on the internet. I just did it myself. I didn't persuade anyone else to. He found a market-side hack to get everyone to. This is my house in Liverpool. I work for a startup called ScraperWiki, based in Liverpool. That helps people analyse data, and this is my house that I bought about a year and a half ago. And when I got it, I didn't really like not very good physical maintenance things. And it just felt like this recalcitrant piece of software, because I'm a programmer. This big, old piece of software, 120 years old, with a bunch of bugs in it. And how can I even remember what they are? And never mind keep track of like, the information I learned about fixing it. So it was completely natural to me. You just use the really nice, simple, easy-to-use GitHub issue tracker. And I use every feature now, so I tag things as to what kind of person might be able to fix the problem. So when I get an electrician around, I can just go to the electrician tag, find all electrical problems, and get them all fixed. I use milestones, so I've got a milestone at the moment for sorting out the yard, with like a whole bunch of bugs tagged in the category. And the fact it was public, I just did that because it was free to use GitHub in public. This seemed to surprise people that I was doing this, to the extent that Wired wrote a whole article about it, and I often found lots of other people who were doing similar things. It was completely extraordinary to me, because obviously bugs in a house are the same as bugs in software, so I'd use a bug tracker to track. It had some quite interesting consequences, just like any other bug tracker. So Mark stayed in my house and found a bug that was dangerous, and he got to his spare room. If you look back, you'll see a bit 6 months later as someone gets locked in the spare room and just fixes it. I then removed the lock, and a blacksmith offered to make a special new bar for the reason it's difficult to fix. There are, of course, other websites that are trying to do this whole building repair thing. So I post up the names of builders and electricians and repairers who I get recommended, and the quotes and things. So on the bug, it'll have like the price of a quote and what different people have said, and then I put the answer. And there are people who try to do that. There are lots of websites that have tried to make it easier to find tradesmen. I really love it if they would just come and look at my bug tracker and offer me, they make me offers for how much it costs to fix things. Other people have forked my repository. This is a guy called Dwayne in Canada. He didn't get a copy of my whole house, but he forked it sort of just to show he got the idea from there. And he's gone further than just tracking bugs. He actually uploads objects that are part of his house to the file store part of GitHub. This is the STL file. GitHub can render like 3D objects now, just by default, just previews them. And this is a little thing for his sink that stops the bits of rubbish going blocking up the sink that he 3D printed, and he uploads the designs and keeps them in there. So there's this idea that we can track maybe everything about our houses like this, and I would love a fantastic feature. It's really easy to maintain a house. I hoped my girlfriend would file more bugs, but she doesn't. She basically can't be bothered to use a bug tracker, thinks it's horrible to have all the things wrong with your house in a big list, and doesn't get, because she's not a programmer, she doesn't get the benefit from her experience of having all the details recorded of everything you know about the particular problem. She does like using this shopping list, which is called Our Groceries, which is just an iPhone and Android and everything. Very simple app, and it's literally instant syncing shared shopping list. And because it's such a simpler concept, it's a shopping list and everyone has a shopping list, everyone doesn't track bugs in an early way. She found it much easier to take up. So the really important thing is about the innovation. You might understand it, but the important thing is, how are you going to get other people to understand it? Are you going to train them? Are you going to do something that they already know how to understand? And there's a real tension between the two. Because if you really want to innovate, you have to change everyone's behaviour and understanding. And that's hard, which is where we get back to the hype cycle again. Geeks aren't always innovators. Sometimes we're not. So in my case, for example, I'm a laggard when it comes to music. I still buy CDs, literally. I do rip them and listen to them on my phone, but I don't buy digital music. I just have loads of really poor excuses. And when you hear someone making excuses about an obvious product that's just going to destroy a previous thing, they're in like mainstream, and they're just going, oh no, but if I don't buy CDs, how will I remember what music I've got, and how will I look at it, and the artwork's not as good, and maybe I'll lose it, or maybe it won't work on my next phone or something, or do I buy Spotify, or it's just too confusing. And when you find yourself going like that about anything, it means that you're kind of in late mainstream, you're about to be destroyed later, or you'll probably die in the next generation. I have in my head, because I'm a mathematician by my degree was in maths, a multi-dimensional space. You've got to sort of think a bit nuts here. Imagine a vast multi-dimensional space. Each point of it represents a specific iota of need, like something someone wants. And the dimensions are things like, each point represents like both the product and the person using the product. I think products and markets are the same thing. So the dimensions are things like, is it in Africa or is it in Europe? Do you need public transport to get there, or do you need a car to get there? Is it a basic need, or is it something further up Maslow's hierarchy of needs? And imagine all the different dimensions of products. And you have like this big blobby shape here, which represents Tesco and all the needs it fulfilled. And you have this other space over here, which is GitHub, and the areas it's doing. And the reason to think about this is that it's territory, it's a war game. And new products are trying to invade this territory. If you make something that is just slap bang in the middle of a place where a company dominates it, you're not going to get any success. You have to make something near the edges, or something where a new technology has created a new piece of territory, or where a social change has created a new territory. I like the idea of Randall Monroe makes XKCD taking LSD and drawing a map of this thing, like all of his crazy maps of the internet. So one of the things that I'm increasingly thinking about is geeks and how to get us to think more about markets and not just to complain when people don't take on innovations and think only about the very early part of. I used to just think about the technology stuff, and then at some point in the mid-90s I started reading books about products and design. Design generally has got better in the last 15 years on the internet. And there's another stage now, I think, which is where we start to think about markets more. And Facebook was a massive market hack, like a hustle of the market side, not the product side. And the more kind of geeks who are well motivated to do that, I think is really important. So thinking about this, the space of the marketplace in a kind of more mathsy, wargamey way is a useful metaphor for a geek to stop it just feeling completely insane. I'm going to say a few other things that people are doing now that will happen in the future. Obviously, Arduino and Internet of Things is something that's happening. You have to be slightly careful to distinguish between things which are already products that you're just an early buyer of and things where people do innovation. So I go to Liverpool's Makerspace and I'm making a thing that tells me when my bin recycling needs to go out automatically, like makes the bin glow. And I don't know why I do it. I have no idea. But I think everyone will probably be doing things like that. See? This is 3D printing, which, again, completely useless at the moment, but great fun. This is bitcoins. I don't think actual coins are kind of interesting, but the really interesting thing is it allows you to do arbitrary contracts that are enforced by a digital majority. There's a great talk about that from the London Bitcoin Conference that I recommend. They're way more interesting than people think, the new algorithm of bitcoins. This is a orangutan's nest taken from an aerial drone. So a guy from Liverpool has making drones and using them to do ecological monitoring. So the things that lots of people are buying drones now for fun, and now you can easily have your own autonomous flying vehicle. I think I'm ending on this one because this market hacking, if you're good at it, You can do really brutal things, and our lives get massively affected by it. So we're all using Facebook, even if we hate it, for lots of other reasons. And that's because they managed to beat us at the market hacking part. And there's a strong ethic, there's like a morality, particularly in the UK, in geek culture, of doing things that benefit benefit society in some way. And if we spend all our time just concentrating on the technology, or even just on design, we're not really going to change the world to be better. So we need to make sure we do things that are useful, like helping orangutans, using the innovations that we think are new, and taking seriously that people won't just use things because they're possible. They have to also understand them, and they have to go through the cycle of phases of innovation. Questions?
I'm wondering how far something like the house mixing to be successful depends on people being willing to be more open with data about themselves. Like, would you go as far as issuing someone an OAuth token to come in and fix your house while you're not there?
Yeah, permissions is a whole fascinating area, and the permissions of openness, complete openness, is just a hack that cleverly gets around the complexity of permission systems. At ScrapeWiki, we struggle over ages with what permission systems we have on our new mission or platform. You look at Google Drive, Google Docs, it's got a million permissions buttons, and there are 7 different dimensions of sharing that we worked out that all applications have, and people expect them all to work. It's insane. But if you make everything open, it makes that much simpler, and that's the great power of open source. It just reduces that kind of difficulty. So yeah, that's an interesting question.
Could you explain a little bit more about the social side, and you and your girlfriend, but what about, like, a lot of plumbers and electricians don't go, you know, and how does that work?
I haven't actually told them that I put their quotes on the internet. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, I mean they, so, you know, how would they be able to find, they won't be able to find you, would they?
No, someone would have to do another. I could imagine someone doing a startup that was like a competitor to My Hammer or Rated People or something, which encouraged people to record, maintain information about their work lists on it, and then created a two-sided market. But you'd have to have a Reid Hoffman type character to do that, to understand the social aspects on it and iterate on it and test it and get it to be popular. Yeah.
How do you find people who traditionally work in product kind of market management style roles? How do I respond to the idea of a multi-dimensional product market?
I think I'm mad, I think. There's a big problem in the UK. It was Andrew Walkinshaw from Timetrics who first drew this to my attention, that basically geeks and product people on the product side are very good friends with the salesmen and marketing people on the market side. And I think in order to have more successful startups, and indeed more successful like public sector startups, we need more of a connection between those two different skills, and I think they're equally important to each other. And any kind of ethical culture that there is needs to be shared, so you need to have some kind of commonality. And to be honest, because of that, I haven't actually asked very many, because you need to find ones who would even have a conversation with you. And there aren't many people I can think of who would even listen to it. But yeah, interesting. I'd love to know if you can ask someone by now.
Not taking on the GitHub aspect of that, but she's very confident with using some kind of to-do list, like a shopping list.
Yeah.
Have you considered merging those two? Like, make the shopping list right to GitHub?
Yeah, that's not a bad idea. It's interesting. No, I haven't. So I should add a shopping list that's called Things I Hate About the House.
Use the shopping list that she's familiar with and gate it into your existing system.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Extra load, but you get it into yours. This is something that I do.
Yeah. Oh, I like that. I might try that. I'll have to look at the APIs for them. Not a scraper.
I write software. My issue tracker is full of issues that never get fixed. How does GitHub help you with that?
Oh, I have the same problem. Yeah, I do fix some of them, and I don't fix other ones, so it's the same. Yeah, same kind of problem. How long have I got? So that's it. 30 seconds. Anyone who's someone at the back, who I keep ignoring?
Hello. In our house, we use a Kanban board on our corridor for stuff that needs doing.
Oh, fantastic.
My girlfriend's not keen on it at the minute. She's just not happy with it. Do you find any other software type techniques in your house?
Not that I do, but I love that you have a Kanban board. That's fantastic. Okay, I've got to stop there, but I'll come to her and talk to you after. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
That wasn't too much.
is James on the Constitutional Excerpts Project.
Alright, so I'll be talking today about Constitute, which is essentially a way for people to search over all countries' constitutions and retrieve excerpts from those constitutions. There's a number of people involved with this project. It's kind of an international team, mostly from the U.S. The big thing to know here is we have technical assistance from the computer scientists at UT Austin. And so all the technical problems, they're not my fault. You can blame those on somebody else, okay? And we are very grateful for financial support from the Indigo Trust, which is a foundation based here in London. So just to give you a little background, my collaborators and I started collecting data on constitutions 8 years ago, all the way back in 2005 through the Comparative Constitutions Project. So we've been cataloging the contents of all constitutions ever written in independent states since that time. And we've collected a lot of data on constitutions. So we've come up with this big chronology of all the constitutions ever written around the world, searching through every country's historical record, and all the changes to those constitutions. Then we went through and we built a repository of texts. So I have texts for 90% of the world's constitutions. And that may not sound like a big undertaking, but there's been over 900 constitutions written and over 2,500 constitutional amendments. So we have over 3,500 constitutional texts, or probably closer to like 3,000 out of 3,500. And roughly 75% of those are in English. And then we went through and developed a survey instrument and asked questions about all those constitutions. And those constitutional texts. Everything from the rights that they provide to the institutional structures that they establish to the actual structure of the text itself. And so our goal is to really utilize the full capacity of this data by allowing people to search over this huge corpus of texts that we have, but do so in a very powerful way. So you might be asking, well, why do we need to do this? Well, the answer is based on really two facts. One is that every year, roughly 30 countries change their constitution in some way. Now, this is probably surprising coming from the UK that has a constitutional tradition dating back to the 1200s, right, the Magna Carta, or the US that's only had one constitution in its existence. It's been amended 20-some times. Well, most countries, that's not the case. So roughly 5 new constitutions are written every year around the world, and around 25 constitutions are amended. What's perhaps a little surprising is that even though there's this kind of significant amount of constitutional change, no one's really an expert at this process. So the constitutional drafters in these countries are doing something they've never done before, and they're never going to do again. So they lack basic information about what's in constitutions and what form those various topics should take. And that's where we see this Constitute tool really serving a greater need. Because it's going to provide exactly that information. People will be able to go to this website, search across all constitutions by some topic, say freedom of religion, and see how freedom of religion is addressed in literally every constitution that's ever been written, okay? Or the vast majority of them. So we think that this is going to improve the constitutions written around the world. But in addition to this, we're kind of increasingly aware that there's, in a lot of countries, people just don't have access to their constitutions and to the laws that govern their actions. And so we think that this is going to be an important source of access to just domestic constitutions. So outside of these periods of great constitutional change, people need to know what rights they're entitled to. They need to know how government functions. They need to know about voting, etc. And this tool will allow them to do that and also compare what's in their country to other countries and see what changes they might need to be made. So, at its heart, this Constitute is a search tool, okay? So you click on the search box, you get a list of topics, and you can search multiple different ways through this. One would be just to navigate through that kind of drop down and pick a topic. Here it's something about revoking citizenship is the one. I don't know if you can see it very well. So if you click on that, it'll do a search for all provisions about revoking citizenship. Alternatively, you can type into the box just like you would expect. It's going to narrow down that list of topics. You can type the whole topic, freedom of religion, in the box, hit enter, it'll take you to that topic. If you enter a topic that's not in our taxonomy, like land reform. We don't have a topic for land reform. Then you'll do just a free text search for that combination of words across our corpus of text. But we really think the power that we're adding here, because you can search through constitutions in a free text sort of way already on different websites. What we're really adding, our contribution here, is this topic-based search. Because we've gone through a lot of effort over the last 8 years to categorize every single paragraph of constitutions into one of these kind of 330 topics that we've come up with. Then you get the search results page. You can filter by various things. Say you are only interested in constitutions written in Latin America, or only constitutions written over the last 20 years. You can do all that sort of filtering from here. There's a couple cool features about this search result page. One is that after you search, say, by freedom of religion, then you can do a free text search for only excerpts that contain something about religion, that contain the word beliefs, let's say. Because an alternative way to frame a freedom of religion provision is something about freedom of beliefs or freedom of consciousness. Another thing that you can do is if you click on a provision, it'll actually take you to the text of the country's constitution so you can read that excerpt in context. So here you can see this is a constitution from Norway. Someone did a search for head of state succession clauses, and Norway came up. They clicked on that excerpt, it takes them here, and then it highlights in the little pink on the right that that provision, Article 3, is about head of state succession. So I've explained to you how this sort of works. Now, how are we going to build this product? So the problem here that we face is we have a text on the left. This is just an example from Angola's 2010 constitution on executive term limits and term lengths. And then we have some topics, this taxonomy that we've created of 330 topics. So we need to match those up to come up with something that looks like this on the bottom, this machine-readable, searchable RDF and N-triples. And I do not claim that this is valid. I kind of wrote this myself based on very little I know about this. But supposedly, we need to convert that text and the topics into some kind of valid form of RDF in this N-triples form, okay? So that we can do searches over it. Well, the key to doing that is actually our data that we've been collecting for the last 8 years. So we have data that on those topics, the tags, and our coders have entered a response to that, and they've also entered the article number. We're perhaps more forward-thinking than usual. We decided when they gather this data, they need to record the source of the data in that every constitution. So we have the article number. So we have some. So given that information, we've written some Python code that semi-automates this process. Okay, and so it takes the article numbers from our data and then matches the tags to that selection of text and spits out something that's like this RDF. Now I say semi-automated because we don't really trust the process. I don't know how many of you are familiar with constitutions, but there's as much variance in the structure of constitutions. There's no two constitutions that are structured exactly the same. So that poses a real problem for writing one piece of Python code that can interpret all those various structures. So we're going to have a coder go back through and just double check to make sure that what the Python code does is actually what it's supposed to be doing. It also checks for errors in our article numbers, whether they be formatted incorrectly or something. That poses major problems for using Python to generate this RDF. So it'll generate the CSV file, it's manually checked, and then we'll turn that into RDF that's searchable. So that's sort of what we're hoping to do, and this is kind of the behind the scenes, how we're going to make it work. So I look forward to, we're in the very early stages still, so I look forward to any questions, comments, suggestions you have. Just a couple concluding remarks. We think this is a really powerful tool, this universal access to these national constitutions for improving governance around the world. We think makes it so powerful, though, is those topics-based searches and utilizing our interpretations of constitutions that we've been doing for the last 8 years or so now. We really think that's going to do two things for empowering domestic actors. It's going to allow individual drafters that are actually involved in constitutional change the opportunity to kind of play a larger role in drafting those constitutions and rely less on international experts who don't really know about the culture, about the social situation in these developing countries. And it'll allow just everyday people, whether they're political activists, NGOs, lawyers, academics, etc., to play a more active role in their country's governance and to help hold their elected officials accountable. So thank you for taking time to learn about this. I appreciate any comments, suggestions, etc. Yeah.
Is the code and data available for download?
Right now, it's still being developed, but eventually it will be, yes.
Okay.